Dr. Peter Ravdin presented the next paper for discussion, the much-awaited NSABP B20 study evaluating the Oncotype DX assay in patients receiving adjuvant tamoxifen plus chemotherapy, a paper that's just been published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology.
Sandy Swain wrote the editorial following the presentation of Oncotype DX's results in B20 and said a step in the right direction. And she started actually by pointing out that the most common presentation of breast cancer today is as node-negative, ER-positive disease. And there are about 100,000 cases of this every year in the United States. And the previous work with the Oncotype DX test has shown that about half of these patients can be identified as having low recurrence scores and therefore low risk of developing metastatic disease within 10 years. And so this test could potentially spare 50,000 women a year treatment with chemotherapy, just on the basis of prognosis alone. And I would agree with her, by the way, absolutely on this, but I'd also say that there are ways of doing this on the basis of tumor size and grade, and we'll come back to that. This isn't the only way that you might do this. There is a statistically significant benefit from chemotherapy in those patients that have high recurrence score. And that's, I think, a very important point. Nature's kind. You have a high risk of recurrence, but you also have a high level of benefit. And ER measurements by IHC, she says, are not quantitative. So even if you wanted to use some of these other methods, they might not be as good as something like the Oncotype DX test. And some patients with high ER also have high recurrence score. So if you just simply used high ER as a correlate for chemo responsiveness, or in this case, resistance, you would be fooled sometimes. And what her conclusion was, it appears that the recurrence score can be beneficial to predict which patients will definitely benefit and which will not. However, the recurrence score is only the beginning. And I think we'd all agree with that comment, that this is a very useful test, but is hopefully something that will be refined, and they're in the process of refining it. Now, if you agree with the editorial, you might conclude that all node-negative, ER-positive patients should get the Oncotype DX test. The major caveat of B20, and that is B20 does not use a single modern regimen that we are using in the clinic. The chemotherapy in this trial was MF or CMF, and it was always given in combination with tamoxifen. So there's possible confounding effects of tamoxifen that might be taking place. Now, how much benefit was seen from the chemotherapy in this trial? And if you take a look at the 10-year results, there really was no benefit in the low-risk group. And in the high-risk group, there's a dramatic benefit. There's about a two-thirds reduction in the risk of development of metastatic disease. So there's a very big net benefit in the high-risk patients. Now, note, however, that these are very broad confidence intervals, although the result does reach statistical significance. They, I think, made quite appropriate, kind of cautious interpretation, not over-interpretation of their data. They said that there were other ways that you might be able to do this, and that there was certainly suggestive evidence that grade was a predictor, UPA Pi 1, ER negativity, high proliferative index, but this 21-gene assay brings a higher level of precision. I think one of the things that's impressive about this test is they've really spent a lot of time showing that the test is something that they could duplicate over and over again on the same sample. And a lot of these other assays depend on immunohistochemistry, in which there's a lot of variation in reviewer assessment.
I'd like to begin with Chuck.
To me, I think something that hasn't come out that I had commented on that I find very interesting is when you go back and look at the B14 placebo patients, their outcome for the high recurrence score and intermediate recurrence score patients is really very similar. There's no difference between the two, just pure prognostic of recurrence score in the absence of tamoxifen. And when you then compare the placebo to the tamoxifen patients, you see a major movement, major improvements for that intermediate group, virtually no movement for the high group. And to me, a utility of this that goes beyond the chemo yes or no question, is there a benefit, yes or no, is I do think when we're talking about giving both chemotherapy and hormone therapy, there are varying degrees of benefit from each of the components for different women. And I think the recurrence score does help counsel a woman on really how important is chemotherapy for you. If she's high recurrence score, that's the dominant part of her therapy. If she's down in the intermediate area, I feel like then the main thing is the hormonal therapy. It's not to say chemo isn't helpful, but I think there needs to be understanding of the importance of the various components that I think this provides counseling information for the risks, benefits, for when women run into toxicities, how hard do they persevere through toxicities and so on. So I think there's some value there just for the clinical interaction from the assay.
Cliff, Craig put up the question of how this is actually utilized in practice and how useful it is. Just to let you know, our Patterns of Care survey a year ago showed 80% of researchers and 35% of oncologists in practice had ordered the test. The most recent survey that we did the last month, it's up to 95% of researchers and 50% of oncs in practice have utilized it. Researchers, an average of 14 patients. Oncologists in practice, an average of 10 patients. So, Cliff, clearly it's not a test that's being utilized in every patient. Where do you see this being most useful clinically?
Well, I have a long answer, I think, to that. First of all, I think that on one level, all the data we see does suggest that for the hundreds and hundreds of pathologists and pathology labs around the country, the alternative of a well-controlled, quantified pathology exam offers something of potential value. And I'm not impugning the reputation of any of the pathologists, but there is something nice about having a single call for some of these important variables. And I think that's something to think about in the longer term. We've seen in multiple settings, both HER2 and ER in the last decades, that inconsistent testing really can lead to improper management with some dire implications in some cases. So that's one potential. The test is not there yet on any level, but that's something that I think they point in the direction of. In terms of practical matters, I see the test right now as a way of confirming a hunch and occasionally surprising you. What I mean is, I see it as the way to essentially convince somebody who's on the fence about chemotherapy that they really should get it. So the borderline case where we're not sure and you get a high recurrence score, I think that provides a very valuable service. I have a little more reservation at the moment about using the test to withhold chemotherapy, and it really boils down to some of the points that Peter highlighted. A low recurrence score does not, with those confidence intervals, exclude the possibility of a benefit. So I think we're left right now still discussing with the patient the values that they bring to the table. Some patients are simply uninterested in chemotherapy, and no recurrence score will convince them. And conversely, there are a fair number of patients, at least in our practice, who, if we don't offer them chemotherapy, they're going across the street to get it, and a low recurrence score is of no particular value to them.
Peter, you showed the data showing that it does predict in larger tumors, but I guess psychologically you see a 2.5 centimeter, 3 centimeter node negative tumor, you get nervous about not using chemotherapy.
I think that that's certainly right. Everyone has their cutoffs for where conflicting data is so strong that they're not necessarily willing to totally accept the result. I think right now that the way these tests are going to be used is they're going to be used in combination with classical information. Now, I've collaborated with John Bryant and Soon Paik, and we've actually compared the two tests in some of their data, and both are independently predictive. And that doesn't surprise me a bit. First of all, 16 genes is unlikely to subsume everything you might find out from pathology. And the other is that we know that once a tumor reaches macro size so you can see it, its signature doesn't change very much as it changes from 1 centimeter to 4 centimeters. But we know that that process takes a period of time, and during that time, it presumably is shedding some cells. And so that it won't surprise me to find that as the studies get bigger, you can see this already in some of the NSABP's work, that classical factors are also independently predictive as well as the Oncotype DX test. So I don't think that this is a question of either or. I think this test has very, very powerful positive elements. It's very reproducible. It combines a number of factors, some of which we're probably not taking into account. And it has that over classical information.
Antonio?
I think both the NSABP and the Genomic Health should definitely be commended for the beautiful work that they have done in terms of going back, doing a prospective validation, but using retrospective data in a very nice, sequential, and defensible manner. And hopefully some of the issues related to the stability of the assay for the individual patients will be addressed by the TAILORx study, specifically for the low-risk group that will not be treated with chemotherapy, receive hormonal therapy in the high-risk group with chemotherapy, and we'll get a sense of what's happening with them. I think the key issue of the Oncotype DX is, like any other test we have in clinic, you should essentially order a test if you're going to do something with that specific information. And the issue is, will you respect the results of the test and proceed accordingly? In my institution, we have essentially requested that the Oncotype DX only be ordered by the medical oncologist if it's going to help us make a decision with the patient. If the patient's coming into the office saying, I want chemotherapy regardless, or there is no way you're going to give chemotherapy, I don't need the Oncotype DX to add to the information. One of the issues that we also deal with is the reliability in some specific patient groups. And one personal anecdote that I have recently was actually a woman who came in with the results of the Oncotype DX in hand for a second opinion. She had already seen two other medical oncologists and got the Oncotype DX herself. And so what she had was a tubular cancer, 0.6 centimeters, ER 100% HER2 negative. And she brought me the results of the Oncotype DX, and I actually, even before I saw the results, I would have said, I actually don't need to order the Oncotype DX for you, because I'm going to expect, if the results are valid, that this is going to show a low recurrence score. You're someone who's going to be treated with endocrine therapy alone, and you're not going to have chemotherapy. And actually, she had a recurrence score of 35. And what that told me was that essentially, I'm not sure I could believe the result of that Oncotype DX, and I told her so. And if you go back to the NSABP validation, if I remember correctly, only about 14% out of those 650 patients were tumors less than a centimeter. So you're talking about 50 or 70 patients with tumors less than 1 centimeter split across all three groups. So I have no idea whether the assay results do apply to that specific tumor in hand. So you have to be very careful if you order a test whether the patient that you have applies to the patient group. And one final comment, it is actually amazing that it has taken us that long, and it has taken us the Herceptin data, for us to truly realize what a poor job we do nationally with ER/PR and tumor grade, etc. And the Oncotype DX could, to some extent, be an expensive way to normalize the variability, but perhaps in some institutions, in some organizations, this may not be necessary. And my personal experience has been, so far, every single Oncotype DX assay I have ordered has come back intermediate group. So it tells me that I either have very high quality tumor grade and high quality ER/PR in my institution, and I can't figure out exactly who's going to be high risk and low risk, or is pure a play of numbers and chance.
Craig, any thoughts?
We all think we're very good at estimating risk, but I do believe that that may not be entirely correct, because we tend to weigh one out of multiple good factors, one bad factor, disproportionately. And I think it's too bad that we have not yet done a study where we test our ability prospectively, so that we find out whether, in fact, we're as good at calculating the risk as we think we are. I suspect we may not be, particularly if you take a broad range of people in different practice settings. And secondly, if we found that, in fact, we weren't as good as we are, and that it resulted in a better distribution of the appropriate therapies for the appropriate patients, the cost of the test might be more than outweighed by the appropriate use of therapies, sometimes not using therapies that are expensive, but most importantly, getting better outcomes. So that's the study that hasn't been done, I think is critical, and we should be doing.
Dr. Bill Gradishar reviewed another data set on the Oncotype DX assay, a study done on patients in the Kaiser Permanente HMO system.
In some circles, this might be viewed as a real-life experience looking at the Oncotype DX assay, as opposed to, I don't know that it's not real-life, the B14 study. But in any case, this was an experience from the registry of Kaiser Permanente, about 5,000-some patients, and from that, culled a group of patients that were viewed as the controls, matched both for age, tamoxifen treatment, other characteristics, including the center from which they came, and they were followed out. And the material was available on these patients to look at the Oncotype DX score, and there is a correlation in terms of risk of actually death, not distant disease-free recurrence, but death. And as you go from low to intermediate to high, the absolute risk of dying from breast cancer increases with an elevated recurrence score. So in many ways, very comparable to what we see in the NSABP B14 study. Now, the other interesting thing, and I think the distinguishing thing between this experience to a certain degree and the B14 study is, as opposed to the B14 study, there's a suggestion in this experience that in addition to simply looking at the recurrence score, that clinical characteristics may also influence outcome in this population of patients. So that as you go from patients with low recurrence scores to those with intermediate to those with a high recurrence score, and then look at some of the characteristics, including tumor grade as well as the size of the tumor, you can further distinguish outcome of patients. And the B14 study was more focused, or the conclusion was that the recurrence score was probably the more powerful discriminator, whereas in this experience, this is a different kind of study, case control study, there is a suggestion when you figure in the tumor size as well as tumor grade going through each of these recurrence score categories, that there is a difference in terms of 10-year risk of dying of breast cancer that increases or changes depending upon those modifiers of tumor size and grade. So I think this is a little bit of a difference between the B14 study and the Kaiser study. But the global thing that I think one can say about this experience is that the recurrence score in both of these trials, or both of these clinical experiences, the NSABP B14 and the Kaiser study, show similar outcomes. And I think the other thing is, as I suggested at the outset, the Kaiser study is an experience that was conducted primarily in the community at a variety of different centers, and essentially showing a very similar outcome in that patients who were not receiving adjuvant chemotherapy were ER positive. As the recurrence score increases, the risk of dying of breast cancer also went up. But there's also another discriminator that seems to be apparent, and that is if you figure in tumor grade as well as size, you may be able to refine even further the outcome of some of the patients that were involved in these trials, more so than any of the factors alone. I think both of these papers highlighted the fact that when we look at things like tumor grade, there's actually a fairly poor concordance between pathologists. It's a point that's been made in both of these papers. They had separate pathologists that were looking at that. So not only grade, not only ER status, not only HER2 status, I think those are important clinical characteristics of tumors, but there's actually not great concordance across institutions. And similarly, RT-PCR looking at proliferation indices are probably better than assays used in individual institutions, which was also demonstrated and reported in both of these papers.
Peter, I produced a version of adjuvant that uses the recurrence score as well as the others just from the NSABP publications and the relative risks in those publications. And I never actually published that. But I think that as the data is strengthened from other sources such as this, that that is appropriate. And hopefully, perhaps working together with the NSABP, such a model will actually be put forth. Because I think that their test does have, as was shown, independent predictive power. Perhaps it's the most powerful thing. I want to mention one thing about such tests, by the way, that's a little bit unfair. And it's something to be aware of. And that is that if you take a group of variables, each one of which is relatively low, and now you group them together, okay, now they look better in a multivariate analysis and knock out a bunch of other things and make them look weak. Whereas if that's not the appropriate way to do it, though, the appropriate way to do it, and it's been done in the SABP papers, is to say, how good a model could we make without including this so that everything that might be subsumed in the test has a chance to shine through? And then you actually include it and show that the model is a more predictive model. And that's an important point, because sometimes clustering things together will make other things look unimportant, whereas if they were given a chance on their own, they would potentially be as powerful.
Dabu?
So this brings up the issue that has been brought up before, and that is if you have a given recurrence score by the Oncotype assay or by some other gene profile assay, is there room for variation within that score? So let's say you take 100 people with a recurrent score of 30. Would the ones that have smaller tumors and lower grade tumors actually do better? So can we cast aside the other factors? And this is very important in the case we heard earlier where a tubular cancer gave a really high recurrence score. My reaction would be to sort of lower that score. And of course, I don't know if that's appropriate or not. The Kaiser data was interesting in that the substrata within the recurrent score categories did show some variation, and it was a small sample size, the confidence intervals overlapped. But I think this is a very important point to be made. Recurrent scores should not be looked at as a very narrow range of risk.
Cliff, we're going to talk later about adjuvant trastuzumab, but does the Oncotype DS assay have a role in patients with HER2-positive tumors?
Well, I think it comes back to the granularity of the data. I think that there certainly are some cases of HER2-positive tumors that have a low oncotype. And so if you weren't considering use of trastuzumab in the context of how we've tested it, it might matter. Since trastuzumab is almost exclusively going to be used with chemotherapy, I don't see the role for the oncotype testing right now. If you're using it to adjudicate a chemotherapy addition, and you've got a factor that boxes you into chemotherapy ready, I don't see why we would need it.
I think in the clinical practice, the way I see the Oncotype DX being used essentially is going to be not for the tumors that are smaller than 1 centimeter, because we don't have data from the validation studies for that patient subgroup, and for the most part, not for the patients with HER2-positive disease. So we're going to be with the patients with tumors greater than 1 centimeter or greater than 2 centimeters, which are HER2-negative.
Chuck?
I guess I would disagree a little bit with the notion that we wouldn't use it in the smaller tumors, because there were some there. We do know that some of those smaller tumors do recur, and that if you've got a situation where you're struggling with a decision to give chemotherapy, and I had a high recurrence score, even in a small tumor, I would add credence to that, because it would suggest that high recurrence score benefit patient is going to have a substantial relative risk reduction. It's hard to imagine that biologically a high recurrence score relative risk reduction is going to be less, and in high recurrence scores, it's very high. From our study, it's 75%. So they're getting absolute benefits that to me become meaningful. I mean, that's to me what you have to work back to is, what are the absolute number range that I'm dealing with here when I'm talking about my chemotherapy, yes or no? And if it's more than 1% or 2%, I think most of us are treating. When we get into that worrying about, are we sure there's not a 1% that I'm missing, I have a hard time with that whole idea that we should be even worrying about that subset of patients, because we haven't shown there's benefit to that degree in those patients yet.
Cliff?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I thought the question was among the HER2 positives, where the Herceptin decision is really...
No, the HER2, I agree with specifically.
But what about the HER2 positive, such as in the survey, ER positive tumors less than 1 centimeter? Not that Oncotype DX would be the end all, but it may be that in fact HER2 drives enough of their score that you're going to get a kind of intermediate or high score regardless, and so it's not going to be a useful determinant. But it is a population of patients, even the 1 to 2 centimeter ER positive. For example, there's a small number of patients that have low-grade ER positive tumors that are HER2 positive, even on repeat testing in FISH. So is it possible that Oncotype DX could be helpful in those patients? I mean, it would be interesting to
look at that. I think that's a research question.
Hmm.
Final comment from Joyce. I'm just kind of curious, in getting back to this theme of clinical research and where we're heading, I was fascinated by how this has evolved over the last couple of years in this collaboration between Genomic Health and the NSABP, and being able to mine data from trials that had been done previously, and particularly this prospective methodology. Steve Schack talks about using the same kind of clinical research methodology to evaluate an assay as we do with therapies. Do you think that this is something we're going to see more of in the future?
Definitely, and I personally wonder about how we'll do as a global community randomizing patients to chemo, no chemo. And personally, I think that, you know, in the TAILORx and MINDAC, et cetera, as we have a lot of these archival sets of data that have long follow-up, and we get increasingly sophisticated at looking at this, and if we're seeing the same story over and over and over again, you know, it may be, as Dan Hayes has suggested, that there will be some consensus panels that will look at this and kind of put it together. Personally, I'd be very comfortable with that because, as Antonio said, there's some concordance beginning to emerge now across various platforms. That's going to help us because all these archival data sets and blocks will be looked at with various methodologies, but if they're giving us similar biological pointers, then I think that's very helpful. I just wanted to make a corollary point. When I was talking to Steve Schack and really trying to pick his brain to try to understand better in my own mind what the potential clinical utility of Oncotype DX might be, he was telling me that it brings to mind your case of the small tubular, you know, with the 35. I was discounting those invasion genes and the CD68 because on the algorithm, they're given like almost no weight. So I'd been thinking that it's all about hormonal receptors and proliferation in HER2, essentially. But he told me that the reason they have such a low weight in the algorithm is that their dynamic range is huge for the invasion genes, for example. And so that if you weighted them any more, that it would overwhelm your recurrence score. So, but he said that the dynamic range, for example, on the invasion genes is so huge that changes across the spectrum can change your recurrence score by about 10 points. Now, I totally did not appreciate that. And so I think it's interesting because we may be seeing something like if that was an ER-positive, PR-negative lobular cancer, for example, whose invasion genes were off the wall, for example, she may not recur fast, but she may recur eventually. So I personally think, and I know Steve Schack intends to do this, I think there's a lot more data mining that they've already done from the NSABP data sets and stuff, and they know a great deal about these individual parameters, I think that will really shed a lot of light and help us more. So I think there's a lot more data yet to come.
Chuck, final comment?
Yeah, just one comment about what Joyce is alluding to that doesn't come out in the papers. John Bryant was the lead statistician with the NSABP for that whole project. And John is a skeptic. John wanted to prove that this didn't add value because he knew it cost money. He kept thinking we can get it simpler. And he worked a long time eliminating all those steps, trying to show that the model didn't decay, and he couldn't do it. So even though a lot of the benefit looks like it is there, and a good bit of it is, it dropped off when you omitted those. I've known that and watched John do that. Maybe that's why I'm more comfortable and don't worry about that so much, because I know how hard he worked trying to break it down, and it wouldn't come apart.
Dr. Cliff Huttis reviewed the next paper published in JAMA by Barry et al., looking at the CALGB experience in terms of benefits of adjuvant chemotherapy based on receptor status. Dr. Huttis began by commenting on the current controversy as to whether a docetaxel-based regimen like TAC provides a preferential advantage in patients with ER-positive tumors compared to paclitaxel regimens like Dostent's ACT.
Everybody wants to get into a debate about TAC and dose-dense therapy, and I think that's a false choice on multiple levels. The first issue is that both of the regimens are clearly more active than what they've been compared against. It's kind of a discussion about whether calamari is better in Sicily or chocolate ice cream is better in Canada. The two things just have very little to do with each other from my point of view. They're both better than, as I say, than not. Having said that, a practical study is the one that Sandy Swain is chairing, and I think it's almost done, right, for the NSABP. It's practically accrued, in which patients are randomized to the TAC regimen or the dose-dense regimen, or this third arm that actually incorporates gemcitabine. And I think this is, again, a practical, pragmatic study, although I would point out to you that regardless of the results, it neither confirms nor validates nor invalidates any particular approach here, because there's no real principle at stake here. It's 6 cycles versus 4 of the drugs. It's Q2 versus Q3. It's differing taxanes and differing dose levels of the anthracycline. So, I mean, it's hopelessly confounded from a principle point of view, and I'm not criticizing it because clinically docs need to know the black and white answer to the question, which regimen should I be giving, and whichever one is triumphant, that's what they should use. Don Burry went retrospectively through these three trials leading up to 9741, and then we could, across these studies, retrospectively generate hypotheses about the value of treatment. Now, one of the places where I differ to some degree with the co-authors is on the issue of ER testing. I'm not confident that our testing is high enough quality to draw conclusions. Also, we did not apply standard and consistent hormone therapy to these patients. So you have to recognize that when you try to interpret this and put it into practice. In the ER negatives, there was a big benefit for higher dose CAF. There was a big benefit for paclitaxel and the big benefit for Q2 versus Q3 therapy. In the ER positives, this was quite different. There was really no discernible advantage for the high-dose version, although it still looks to the eye as though the low-dose version of CAF is probably inferior. And I think there are really two take-home points. The first one is that chemotherapy for ER-negative breast cancer, both in terms of recurrence and death, is a profoundly effective treatment and one that shouldn't be scoffed at. In fact, in terms of an indirect comparison, it probably puts you in the same ballpark as hormone therapy does for ER-positives and, frankly, as trastuzumab does for the HER2-positives. For ER-positive disease, the point estimates are pretty close to half that size. They don't exclude no benefit at all, but the estimate of benefit 5 years still remains favorable, and I'd say above the threshold that most patients would consider worthwhile. An important caveat here is that this data does not address the question of whether chemotherapy works in ER-positive disease. What it addresses is the question of differences in chemotherapy in ER-positive disease. You would need a chemotherapy untreated control arm for the basis of comparison. Some will argue that the low-dose version of CAF in 8541 was no-dose chemo, but that's not technically true, and that's one of the places where, again, the data lets us down. It doesn't let us address that basic existential question, does chemo work in this subset, in my opinion. The explanation that Don has put forth is that it's about the hazards, and this is more important than just a little parlor game because this speaks to the biology of breast cancer. ER-negative disease having a more rapid proliferation early on, and you see a high spike in recurrence risk, which is driven down by the better chemo. You don't see that in the ER-positives because they don't have the early high risk, and in fact, over the 20 years, their risk is fairly consistent. This is the sobering news about ER-positive disease, that just because you get through the first 5 years doesn't mean you're really out of the woods. You're quite the opposite. You see the same thing for paclitaxel or not. The whole benefit is in reducing the early hazard of recurrence. The ER-positives, and you don't have that spike. The dose-dense data, you can see again that there's a reduction in hazard for the Q2 compared to Q3, and you don't see it in the ER-positives.
Tom, there's an intergroup study now in the node-negative patients that is looking at dose-dense AC and also dose-dense T or paclitaxel alone without the full combination of the two. What are your thoughts about either of those strategies, particularly the AC dose-dense in a non-protocol setting?
Well, what the trial is looking at, all the patients are getting dose-dense treatment, so it's specifically looking at the duration of treatment and the comparison of the two regimens. I think in node-negative breast cancer, if you're choosing to give just the AC, the question then becomes, in C9741, what's the benefit from dose-dense AC, from dose-dense paclitaxel, or the whole package? And I think since it was envisioned as testing a concept, that we ought to draw that conclusion at this point. So I think that every two-week treatment is acceptable. I'll have to say I don't always do it, but I think it's an acceptable treatment in node-negative breast cancer. I guess I haven't taken the leap that it's absolutely necessary because there was one negative trial, as you know, with an epirubicin-based regimen.
Dabu, how are you approaching the selection of chemotherapy in node-positive patients? How do you factor in the estrogen receptor status, and have you utilized the dose-dense AC without T in any patients?
Well, it's clear that estrogen receptor is important. We've actually known this for a long time, initially in the metastatic setting and then with the Oxford overview analysis, although never definitive because a small percentage of those patients actually had ER and PR done. So it's not surprising that we're now finding that these patients derive a smaller benefit, but they still benefit, so that has to be factored in. It all boils down to really using the best multiplier to calculate one's benefit. The big question is, should we be changing the numbers we currently use to say what is the risk reduction from chemotherapy and now assign a different number to those with ER-positive versus ER-negative disease? I think we should, if not in a semi-quantitative way, to actually get the numbers and incorporate this into the model. And I'd like to, at some point, hear Peter Ravdin's comment as to whether that may be in the future in his model. In regards to dose-dense therapy in combination with trastuzumab, I'm still using the Q3-week regimen that was used in the intergroup and NSABP studies, although certainly as more safety data comes in, as we get more follow-up from the Memorial Sloan Kettering study, I'm going to, just like with many other changes in my practice, incorporate them slowly as more data comes in. What I think is interesting is that the cardiotoxicity may actually be a little bit lower Certainly, statistically, we can't say that, but I always projected that we might see slightly more cardiotoxicity when we use a dose-dense anthracycline, but in fact, that simply has not been seen, and the trend, as we saw, is in the other direction.
Peter?
Well, I think it's still somewhat of an open question as to what the magnitude is of the impact of ER on chemosensitivity. Incidentally, it's almost certainly not ER, of course. It's going to be topoisomerase and other things that fly together in correlation with ER. Right now, the model actually does incorporate a modest adjustment that is based on the overview analysis, which shows that for simple regimens in postmenopausal women, that there's more proportional benefit in the ER-negative patients than the ER-positive patients. Interestingly enough, and one of the big, I think, disappointments of the last overview, which wasn't really an official overview in 2005, it was very incomplete, the data was not well integrated into the process. What PITO had concluded was that when one included the complex anthracycline regimens, there was no sign of any impact of ER. Now, that flies into the face of what we've just seen and a lot of other information. And I think that the overview, which is being redone this year, one of the things that almost everyone wrote in and demanded was a very careful analysis of this question, because this is the question of how much we should be adjusting things. And three CLGB trials that all fall the same way invite such an analysis. But whether or not it's really the case, I think really does require the inclusion of other trials in which this effect has not been seen. For instance, in the TAC-FAC trial, the better regimen, there was no difference. And in some other major trials that have been completed, there's been no difference on the basis of ER. I think it's real, but I'm unsure as to what the magnitude of the effect is.
Tom?
Well, we know from the Oncotype studies that there is a subset of patients who are ER positive who have a 75% risk reduction with chemotherapy, so that clearly ER is not the only determinant here. And we all know that patients who have ER-positive tumors are not all 100% ER-positive. There are ER-negative cells and clones that presumably benefit from chemotherapy. So I think we're going to have to work harder to identify who's going to benefit from the treatment. It's not just ER.
Final comment from Chuck. Putting patients on the B38 study, you're seeing people getting both TAC as well as dose-dense AC paclitaxel as well as the experimental arm. Any observations or data we have, and just quality of life, the things Joyce was talking about, fatigue, et cetera, comparing TAC to dose-dense AC paclitaxel?
Of course, what we have to look at are our toxicity tables, mainly looking at 3s, 4s, and 5s. We are specifically going after grade 2 neurotoxicity and a few of the other things that we know lower grades do matter. But the striking thing so far is that the regimens really aren't segregating in terms of toxicity to the degree that I think a lot of us thought we might see. We're not going to pick up grade 1, grade 2 fatigue differences with what we're doing. And those things, certainly in the clinic, you can see that. But the major toxicities that are monitored on the trials, we're not seeing really any apparent differences with the cytokine support that everybody gets on the trial.
Dr. Craig Henderson reviewed the next paper that he co-authored with Dr. Dan Hayes evaluating the impact of adding paclitaxel in the adjuvant setting based on HER2 and estrogen receptor status in patients on CALGB-9344, a study that Dr. Henderson chaired.
It was designed initially to look at three different doses of doxorubicin, which people oftentimes forget. The Taxol was an add-on. In fact, the trial had pretty much been designed, agreed upon, was about ready to go. When Taxol was approved, everybody was anxious to know about Taxol, and we added it. And it really created a confounded study in many ways, but the Taxol issue obviously became the positive and the more provocative. Now, we did do, as you've already heard from Cliff, an unplanned subset analysis where we looked at the effects of adding Taxol in all patients. There's a highly significant reduction in the hazard ratio, or the hazard ratio is favorable in favor of the taxane group. If we look at it, however, in the subset of patients, two-thirds of the patients who are ER positive, in fact, it's not significant. If they're ER negative, it is highly significant and larger than the effect seen in overall. So most of the effect seems to be in this group. It was rather interesting that the FDA seized on this and immediately wanted to approve the drug only for the ER negative patients, coming back to Cliff's point. And four of us from CLGB went to the hearings, the ODAC hearings, and argued very passionately against it. Bob Temple was rather interesting in saying that if any company had recommended an approval or disapproval based on such a subset, unplanned subset analysis, they would never approve it. But in fact, he had argued for it. In the end, they played, I thought, a little bit of a dirty trick by putting the data for the two subsets completely separate at the beginning of the product insert. So in a way, they could say they won, even though they didn't approve it just for that group. So now we go on to HER2. And data in the HER2 negative group, in fact, there was very little evidence of benefit from paclitaxel compared to the HER2 positive group, where it was much more robust. Now, there were four subsets that could be defined by HER2 and ER, the group that was ER negative and HER2 negative. Paclitaxel, in fact, was very advantageous in this group. They constituted about 30% of the entire group. Those patients who were ER negative and HER2 positive had maybe a slightly greater benefit. The third group were those who were ER positive and HER2 positive. Now, you remember that in ER positive as a whole, paclitaxel did not seem to have much of an advantage. But in this small group, which only 6% of the entire population of patients studied, there is a very large advantage for the addition of paclitaxel. And then finally, in the patients who are both ER positive and HER2 negative, this is over half of all of the patients, there appeared to be no advantage for adding paclitaxel at all. So in conclusion, the patients with tumors are ER positive and HER2 negative and who are treated with tamoxifen derive little or no benefit from the addition of paclitaxel. Is HER2 only predictive for paclitaxel, or is this generalizable to all cytotoxic therapies? My bias, but of course we don't have such data at the present time, is that this is not a paclitaxel phenomenon, but rather a chemotherapy phenomenon. People have generated both some preclinical data, and I always say between the time physicians see some data and the time they generate a hypothesis is about 2 to 3 milliseconds. And so it was very quick for people to figure out and think of reasons why paclitaxel might, in fact, be related to the receptor positivity and not other chemotherapies. And I'm certain the same thing could be said here. But in fact, we didn't start with a pretty compelling hypothesis. So I think that would be retrospective. And I suspect that this is a generalized phenomenon.
Following Dr. Henderson's comments, I asked Dr. Huddis to comment on another ASCO paper based on the CALGB experience by Dr. Hai Muss, evaluating the risks and benefits of adjuvant chemotherapy in older patients.
What Hai did is he went back through the same CALGB data set and identified the relative benefits of the chemotherapy regimens, not with regard to ER status, but just with regard to age. And basically, the take-home point is that patients who were able to go on these trials were just as likely to benefit from chemotherapy decisions as were younger patients, that is, older patients who went on the studies. And I don't think you can say much more than that, but there is obviously a tremendous series of issues there. Firstly, our enrollment of patients in the older age groups is really very low. I think only 12% of the patients on 9741 were above age 60. And that same kind of proportion holds for the other studies as well. So our experience in the randomized setting for the patients in the older age groups is really not so great. I can tell you that within Memorial, Arte Heria has looked at this in non-randomized studies and sees, I think, what you'd predict, which is that when the docs get more aggressive and permissive with regard to the use of the regimens, the toxicities actually go up. We do have experience of significantly more neutropenic fever and complications in the older patients and intolerance for therapy in these non-randomized retrospective looks than we report in the prospective studies.
Bill?
And the other piece that you alluded to in Hai Muss's paper was the treatment-related morbidity, which it's clear the benefit is equivalent, the morbidity is higher. And the take-home point, because I wrote the editorial of that paper, was that you have to, as we all do, balance efficacy against morbidity, which is probably even a more acute issue in older patients. And there are a variety of tools that one can implement and utilize to figure out whether a patient's going to tolerate it or not. But at the end of the day, it's a gestalt. In our own sense, in my own personal sense, as patients, if they're in pretty good shape, tolerate dose-dense therapy probably as well as other things you might choose. And, you know, there are efforts. One such effort was a CLGB study looking at Xeloda single-agent arm for such patients. And it might be arguable whether dose-dense therapy is probably a friendlier approach, perhaps, than some of the patients who've experienced Xeloda as a single agent. My own view is that you have to get a sense whether the patient will tolerate therapy, number one. And if so, and if you think they will, then use what you think is best.
Rowan?
Yeah, one of the other issues when we talk about elderly is it seems like this cutoff of 65 that we commonly use seems to be pretty low. And when I talk to oncologists in my own practice, it seems like before I start to click in as to make an adjustment, it's probably like 75, especially if somebody doesn't have comorbidities. And so I think some of the data that's being generated, I think many of us would impute that we could give it to a healthy 68-year-old without much difficulty. And it's just a question, as we get higher, how does this balance out?
Chuck?
Follow up on what Bill said in terms of the B38 toxicity we're seeing. I do think that doctors are out there with a bias that not all patients are up for TAC. And so B38 reflects how patients who are deemed candidates for TAC do with TAC versus dose dense. So I think us saying that we're not seeing a difference there shouldn't be used to extrapolate, well, maybe I can push TAC in older patients, that different population.